Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying, multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which have sadly included pregnancy loss, I am finally pregnant. Hi there, and welcome to episode 4 of the Finally Pregnant podcast. I'm going to keep this intro really very short because my guest today, Anya, is just amazing and talks at length about pre and postnatal mental health. And I think it's so important, I'm just going to let her do the talking, to be honest. All I want to say is thank you again for everyone who's listening and subscribing. Please make sure that you do rate and review because it really does help. And yeah, just get in touch with your feedback. Tell me what you want to hear. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. And that's it, really. I'm just going to hand over now to the interview with Anya Hayes. Take care. Hi there. So I am here today with Anya Hayes, who is an author and speaker, and she focuses particularly on women's health and wellness. She's also a Pilates teacher and an author of several books, including The Supermum Myth, Pregnancy, The Naked Truth, Pilates for Pregnancy, and is currently working on a book about Pilates for post-pregnancy. Very, very busy, runs an amazing Instagram account called Mother's Wellness Toolkit. So you can head over there and see Anya. And all of this will be in the show notes as well. Anya, how are you doing?
Hello, thanks for having me. It's really nice to be here.
Oh, I really, really appreciate you joining us, actually. Now, there's something else that I was totally going to trip over, and I'm going to try it. And if not, you can say it. You're training to teach mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. I did it. Yes.
Yeah, you did it. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is shortened to MBCT. So from now on, I'll just say that rather
we'll just
than
say
the mouthful. Yes.
Yes.
And yes.
And it says here, which is the NICE recommended treatment for depression and anxiety.
Yes, exactly. So it's becoming, particularly for cases of recurrent depression or people who are presenting with anxiety symptoms in the longer term, instead of a 6-week CBT course or one-to-one counselling referral, it's now recommended that people are referred to MBCT group sort of therapy slash talking sort of counselling. So it's not one-to-one clinical therapy, it's mindfulness based, but working on the same kind of tools that CBT offers you in terms of like looking at your thought processes and tracking your mental patterns and emotional responses to those mental patterns, etc.
That's really interesting, like combining them. So a couple of years ago I self-referred to the CBT course via my doctor, but I had ended up signing up to a mindfulness course, which I paid for, actually. And I thought, I don't want to do both of them. You know, I'd end up being confused. But the fact that now they're joining them both, which I'm sure they probably were then, to be honest. I just wasn't aware of it. Apologies, we had a little technical glitch there. So you were saying, Anya, that MCBT is relatively new.
Yes. So it's sort of in the 1990s, they began to marry a course which was called mindfulness-based stress reduction with elements from CBT, specifically for people who were suffering from depression. So looking at mindfulness as a sort of, well, within a clinical setting, but then now it's being more, you know, spread to within just sort of a general population. Simply to make people offer people tools generally day to day to look after their mental health before, you know, in a preemptive fashion. So before you might become depressed, learning how to recognize those patterns and recognizing your physical response to stress and anxiety and that kind of thing. So for me, the reason I was sort of intrigued by it was because after my postnatal experience or my birth experience, I was on a waiting list for CBT for months and months, like a long, long time. And I actually became pregnant in the time that I was on a waiting list. And when you're pregnant, you should be fast-tracked for perinatal mental health services. But unfortunately, you know, the system is very pressured. And I didn't get through my appointment until I had a newborn in my arms, it was suddenly completely impossible to take up that appointment. So actually then later on, when I was writing the Supermum Myth with the, I wrote it with a clinical psychologist called Dr. Rachel Andrew, and she didn't really know much about mindfulness. And so that became one of the therapies that we were drawing from, but I sort of decided to make that my speciality. And I learned about MBCT, and I hadn't realized how beautiful it is, that marriage between mindfulness and the cognitive behavioral therapy, and how it is such a kind of just can be really transformative tool to learn for your day to day. So I personally, on my personal journey, found that I resonated with MBCT slightly more than my CBT journey, which wasn't as successful, partly logistically, because I wasn't able to get on the NHS that referral, but also then didn't have the resources to go privately. So MBCT is a way of offering those people those tools, but in a much more accessible and financially realistic way. So that's partly why the NHS has recommended it, the NICE have recommended it as being the pathway for depressed and anxiety presenting patients. So yeah, if you don't know much about MBCT, it's definitely worth just Googling it. Just have it, Ruby Wax actually is a big mindfulness-based cognitive therapy advocate. She trained in that, and so that's in her wonderful book Frazzled. If you haven't read, I would definitely recommend. She talks about her MBCT journey.
Okay, and so are you saying there, and I'll put this into context, I guess, but we don't have a lot of money. And the more than you say, we've spent, personally, my husband and I have spent over £40,000 on our treatment, and yeah. I am seeing a counsellor at the moment, which I'm paying for myself, because I think it's really important. And it was actually a conversation in an Insta Live I did within the community about pregnancy after infertility that I think I've mentioned on other episodes as well. One of the girls said that really she hadn't dealt with her positive pregnancy test even once her baby was in her arms. Now, It's so difficult because you're constantly trying to deal with today's emotions, and there's a build-up of everything that's gone before that you can't clear. And so after that conversation, I did, re-seek out a counsellor. It's something that I've done over the years, certainly. But I'm paying for it. Now, when I spoke to my midwife, and one of my sisters is training to be a midwife in a different area, but she told me about how their midwifery kind of group has got what they call a vulnerable women's team, which isn't necessarily the right name, I don't think. I'm big enough and ugly enough to kind of ask to be part of that team. I think that as a preemptive thing. But when I asked, my midwife looked at me and kind of said to me, they won't see you. And I was like, I am asking for help. Asking for it. And by the end of the appointment, I made sure that I had cried that might have made her think twice.
I think this is a whole area in itself, isn't it? But that's the really difficult aspect about mental health issues, where if you present as coping well, in inverted commas, it can be really hard to access the help that you need. But even if to be perfectly honest, I went to the GP sobbing and still wasn't referred to anything. So it's really tricky. And I think we're at a time when you are vulnerable, you are feeling vulnerable, it's very hard to advocate for yourself. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're fobbed off in any way, the NHS is under so much pressure that it's unfortunate that we do have to kind of push for access to resources that might otherwise not be offered to us. But I would say definitely that in terms of investment in your health, mental and physical health, this is your life. It's something that, it's not the latest buggy. It's not a Moses basket. It's not something that you're buying just for now, for comfort, convenience, trend. Investing in your physical and mental health is so paramount. And I would say that if you can siphon off money in order to access counselling services, or subsequently in your postnatal journey, or even now, access women's health physio services, which similarly aren't always there as a standard pathway of care, then do. That should be, we'll talk about this, I'm sure, in a bit later on in the podcast, but that's as far as I'm concerned, that's part of your mother care plan that you need to have in place. So we talk about a birth plan, and everyone talks about pregnancy ending in the birth, and that's sort of almost like the World Cup final. We think less about how we can prepare and how we can invest in that time afterwards, which is so crucial to how it sort of frames your motherhood experience for the next years, you know, the next 10 years even, how you enter it. You'll be setting patterns in place. So it's really important to think about it as a priority. But just simply in terms of resources, yes. So if you can look up, if anyone's listening and they are struggling and they either haven't been to their GP to ask about CBT, or because CBT is generally the referral pathway for, if you're presenting with postnatal depression, you will usually be offered a CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy course. But, you know, as I say, waiting lists are under so much pressure. And if you feel like you just want maybe to just learn some or have a bit of understanding of what might be going on in your brain, I think it's one of those things, we just have our brain every day, but we don't really understand its workings. And you can unlock so much power by just understanding your mental thought processes and your patterns. So looking at mindfulness-based cognitive therapy would be a way of kind of just thinking, okay, how can I build resilience for all of the amazing, wonderful stuff that's coming at me with pregnancy and birth, particularly after fertility issues, because it's, you know, it is a journey, and you have to give yourself that backpack of resources to keep you going. So a little map and some snacks. That's
I love the idea of a backpack of resources. So what can we do? So we're 2, 3, 4, 5 months pregnant, maybe a little bit later. What can we do? We want to prepare ourselves. You know, I know that my big thing, and you know, you can't unhear some of these things, that there can be a link to postnatal depression and fertility treatment. I've had a look at a couple of links that you sent through to me, and they weren't as conclusive as that, if I'm honest. They more said that there was more disparity about self-esteem rather than actually depression and anxiety, which I took as a positive. Like, I don't want us to have less self-esteem than someone who has conceived naturally, but I would prefer that. I'd take that over anxiety and depression. But what my counsellor did say to me when I was talking to her and saying, right, I'm trying to get everything in place, I'm trying to, you know, really prevent this, and she turned around to me and she said, not everyone gets postnatal depression, you know?
Yeah.
So
I think I would really, really advise unhooking your hope for control about it, because the element of control when you're talking about, well, when you're talking about motherhood in general, but certainly when you're talking about preventing the development of certain symptoms, that makes you, that heightened awareness of it can be a good or a bad thing. So I would definitely say, looking at it in terms of trying to prevent it has to be in a gentle fashion of understanding where, how it might present, how it might manifest, and how you can notice it. So noticing is the big thing. I think so often, you know, we imagine postnatal depression to arrive as a clear black fog, if it arrives, you know, at all, and we wait for it to hit, and we sort of, I think the trouble is with society is we either view motherhood as being joyful and wonderful and Lady Madonna, Mona Lisa smile on her face, gently and serenely breastfeeding her baby, doing everything beautifully and well and calmly. A good mother is a calm and sort of wonderfully prepared mother. And on the other end of that, you're either wonderfully joyous Mona Lisa, Lady Madonna, or you are depressed. And I think this is where we need to pick apart the fact that the postnatal depression, the symptoms of postnatal depression appear on a spectrum from mild to severe. And those mild, the symptoms on the mild end of the spectrum, some of them are just normal aspects of being a new mum and a mum generally. So it's really important to know what your baseline for normal, in inverted commas, is, and then start to notice day to day whether you're feeling like you're not at your benchmark of normal. Now, everyone, when they have a baby, however they got there, so whatever their fertility journey might have been, whatever their birth experience might have been, will feel on some days absolutely overwhelmed, tearful, exhausted, depleted. Those are kind of pretty much guarantees of motherhood at some point. So the key is not to, when you feel on those days, not to jump on that and think, oh my God, I'm depressed, and then load on kind of feelings of guilt or shame or embarrassment or fear on top of that. And it's noticing your mental reaction to what you're physically going through, I think, is the most important thing to cultivate going into pregnancy, so going into birth. So it's not, what can I do to prevent this happening in a controlling way? It's more, I'm going to be accepting and aware of everything that's going on in my body and my mind. And if I feel at any point that I am going over this benchmark of normal, if it's affecting me in my day-to-day much more than I'm comfortable with, I am going to seek help and seek support in whatever way that I can. And I'm going to acknowledge to myself that I need that support, because I think often we're so, you know, the idea of postnatal depression is seen as something that is a failure or is a sign of weakness. And actually, there are so many factors that might lend themselves or lead to you suffering from depressive symptoms. And actually, yes, so, you know, suffering from having trouble in your fertility journey, suffering miscarriage, previous episodes of depression, your support network, all of these things do influence your sort of predisposition to depression. But it also may come out of the blue. So it's one of those things that you can't sort of go tick, 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 I'm definitely a candidate or I'm not. You just have to be aware day to day of how you're feeling and be prepared to act on how you're feeling and try and find out ways through it. And I think that's the most important thing. So it's sort of, rather than whipping up fear about it happening to you, it's more helpful to kind of learn about what the natural and normal things that will happen in your emotional journey as you enter motherhood. What's normal, what's in that framework, and that what is in that spectrum from mild to severe. And then start tracking whether you feel like, okay, actually, this is something that's affecting my day to day. This is, maybe I should go to my GP and say, you know, I'm experiencing this. So, for example, for me, I had three miscarriages in my journey through to having my two children. And after my third miscarriage, I then got pregnant with my second baby. So he was my fifth pregnancy, and I was very much on the list for potential postnatal depression. But actually, my second baby, I really didn't have the same symptoms at all as I did first time around when I hadn't asked for help at all. So like, I think it's also, it is quite random. Motherhood is one of those very random, beautiful, wonderful, kind of terrible, awful, fantastic journeys in your life, which you just have to prepare as much as you can by learning and sort of being open, but also release that sense of, I'm going to expect to control this in the way that I've controlled, say, my working life, or my, you know, there are things that you can control and you're led to believe you can control in life. But then motherhood is one of those things that, unfortunately, that all those controlling rule books go slightly out the window. And that's why something like mindfulness is so important, because actually it allows you to just sort of notice your day to day a bit more without autopilot. So lifting yourself out of that kind of just going through life as you always do in habit, for, you know, in a kind of routine way. And noticing and thinking, actually, is this okay for me? That my inner critic is constantly undermining me at the moment, or I'm having crippling self-doubt. Those are aspects of, you know, on the spectrum of postnatal depression, which we don't really. So for me, for example, I assumed, or the assumption of postnatal depression is that you are withdrawn, or you lack that ability to bond with your baby. There's no love, you know, you're kind of listless and without joy. Now, for me personally, actually, first time round manifested a lot more in just incredible anxiety and heightened self-criticism, heightened sensitivity to other people's criticism, you know, feeling immense love and sort of a huge attachment to my baby, but losing love for myself, I think, you know, that's a sort of way of describing it. But so because I didn't identify with the label of postnatal depression, it didn't really occur to me. And I also didn't feel like I had the support network from my GP or something, to didn't really occur to me to reach out for support. this is also 7 years ago. So actually there really wasn't, as you say, you know, now there are perinatal mental health teams for vulnerable women. So there's much more of a kind of, you know, let's look out for finding these women who might be the, I'm fine, everything's fine, when actually we're struggling. But I do think it's really important to point out that even if you don't suffer from postnatal depression per se, you will have those days where things are you're struggling and it's hard, and that's totally normal. And I think the trouble is at the moment we either frame it as you're coping brilliantly or you're depressed. And until there's a bridge between those two points, when you are on the having an overwhelmed day, if you're allowing those days to go by without acknowledging them to anyone, without saying, actually, do you know what, I do need a bit of help, that general depletion day by day can lead itself or develop into depression if left unchecked. So that's really important to be aware of as well, that if you are kind of suffering from things like just feeling totally exhausted and therefore, you know, not being able to stop that inner critic in your mind telling that you're doing a terrible job, if you're not able to notice that and catch it before it turns into, you know, a habit that you're really not aware of at all, then over continued repeated mental grooves, that can turn into a depression episode without being caught in time. So it's just, I think, being aware of the natural and normal circumstances of motherhood lending themselves to feeling low, tearful, overwhelmed at times. Knowing that's normal can be actually really powerful in realizing that you're not necessarily suffering from postnatal depression in inverted commas, but also to draw in, gather in tools to start to help you feel better. And that's what I think, that's the thing that we don't do so well yet for mothers is create this kind of mother care plan as opposed to a birth plan for those days, which were totally normally you will think, oh God, this is really hard and I'm not good enough and I can't do this, comparing yourself to other people. And then that's when, if you have had a sort of tricky fertility journey, when I think there's a danger when you're struggling to conceive that you then see having a baby as being the perfect ideal outcome and everything will be perfect once I have my baby in my arms. So then to get to your reality where some days just aren't perfect and they aren't for everyone and they're going to be hard for everyone. But then you can, because you wanted it so much, you can then start being self-critical, saying, I'm not enjoying this enough. And I, you know, and you feel guilty for not enjoying your baby enough when you've wanted it so much. It's really sort of common pattern that the guilt for how you're feeling, and that just generally clouds your day to day. And that can, if unchecked enough and unnoticed, become a slightly more serious symptoms of depression beyond that.
I think that you've hit the nail on the head like several times during that, to be honest. And there's a few points that I want to pick out from what you've said, but just there at the end with the guilt. And I know that part of the issue, should I say, around fertility pregnancies or, you know, fertility treatment pregnancies is that as well. You know, there's an element of, yes, we're pregnant, brilliant, yeah, that's it. But actually that isn't the goal, you know, and even holding the baby is the goal, but it's actually being a mother, you know, there's so much more to it, just the next step in the journey. But we're so guilty almost for being pregnant, especially if we do talk really openly, you know, and have friends who are trying to conceive, and, you know, especially, you know, with the Instagram community, that we do withdraw because of that guilt, because we don't want to upset anyone else. So it's great that we're talking about that more, and I really praise that. And that's one of the reasons, you know, this very podcast exists, because we need to realize that actually we need support at this stage, and then we'll also, you know, like everyone else, need support once we have our babies as well. I want to go back to something that I said, because I feel like I kind of poo-pooed it a little bit about the, you know, the self-esteem versus anxiety and depression. And as you were talking, I was thinking, we're often quite desperate to put a label on things. And I always remember listening just very randomly to a Jimmy Carr Desert Island Discs. And he said during that conversation, and it stuck with me, and this was several years ago, how Was he talking about himself or his mum? I can't remember. But ultimately, he was saying that they weren't depressed, but they were incredibly sad. And actually, sadness is underrated. Yeah, and yeah. That is a line that I have used because I have been incredibly heartbroken and sad throughout this entire journey. I don't think that I've been depressed. And I say that having a close family member who has suffered from depression for decades. Yeah. And so I'm very aware of, you know, of them. And it is something that I definitely watch out for in myself. But I don't think that I am necessarily have been depressed, but I know that I have been heartbroken. I know I've been sad. So when I was talking earlier about kind of I'd take low self-esteem over anxiety and depression, like what you've just said is actually, you know, too much of that can lead to other things. And actually that is an issue. It is something that we need to kind of say to people. Absolutely. That we're feeling really low.
And it's really important as well to one of the symptoms of postnatal depression or depression generally, but related to postnatal depression particularly as well, is feelings a lack of self-efficacy. So a feeling of being good at something or being sort of able to do something. And so often within pregnancy and motherhood, we hear this word failure. People use it like, you know, bandy it around like it's nothing. And it's really, really undermining of your confidence, of your feelings of self-efficacy to be able to get something done when you feel like you've been a failure at getting pregnant. Or for example, I didn't have any trouble getting pregnant, but I had trouble keeping pregnancy. So I felt like a failure compared to someone who just got pregnant and had a baby and there was no problem at all. And the self-efficacy sort of, it's very related to self-esteem, I think, in terms of sort of how good you think you are. And the trouble is that's, you end up comparing yourself to other people. And it's really, you know, it's, you can't really avoid it. But with fertility, it's such an emotional area where you end up internalizing someone else's experience as being a reflection of how your experience isn't as good or, you know, isn't good enough. And as you say, when you're then emerging out of that and becoming you, you know, when you do get pregnant, you're so hyper aware of how other people are receiving that news that you then feel guilty. And that's, you know, you layer on this sort of negative feeling around it, which unless we're aware that we're doing it, can just be very damaging for just generally how our nervous system is feeling. You know, we feel kind of on a constant state of stress and high alert. That's not, even if we don't feel depressed. I think depressed is a tricky word, isn't it? Because we have such a sort of imagination of what that means and an image, a visual image of what that means. And actually it can manifest in so many different ways. And so I think almost the labelling of depression needs a kind of upgrade because, you know, I think a lot of women are not identifying with that label, but they are still suffering and experiencing symptoms which, you know, do need a little bit of support and help and guidance. And so, as you say, self-esteem doesn't sound like very much, but actually day to day, if that's taking a beating, that's informing the way that you're viewing your entire, you know, experience.
Absolutely, definitely. No, it just, you know, it just makes you think that you just need to, yeah, pay attention to all of you, really, don't you? It's not, we're not looking out for one thing and we're not looking out for one thing on one day. It is because we're going to have up and down days. You know, we all do in life generally. Exactly. And because of the addition of, you know, the sleep deprivation, the shock, the awe, the magic, the, you know, the noise, the hormones and everything, like it is going to be, once again, we find ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, from the fertility community, on an emotional roller coaster. Yay! We thought we'd left that word behind, or that phrase behind, but sadly not. But it's a whole new roller coaster we need to just try and not necessarily even out, but just be aware of. And are there more ups and downs? Are there, you know, just, yeah, kind of make notes on and see how we're getting on with it.
Yeah, someone, I really like the idea. I mean, when you talk about roller coaster, if you imagine that actually being on a roller coaster and imagine being blindfolded on a roller coaster, that's exactly how early motherhood feels. And then it's the kind of exactly the same euphoria / fear / where am I going? And then once you've finished, you're like, oh, I want to do it again. It was really fun. So we do have kind of sense of amnesia of like But, you know, it is. You have to be open and inviting to the whole experience. And it is bonkers. It's a completely, it's one of those things that you cannot in any way adequately describe what it's like to have a baby. And I think the trouble is that you do hear the bad stuff, the, you know, the stuff that you can't really identify with how much that sleep deprivation is going to affect you. You can't imagine. I remember thinking before I had a baby, I was like, is it like having a cat? You know, does it just sort of hang around with you and you can just, it sits on your lap occasionally and but then goes away? I just had no, you can't imagine. But you also can't imagine, you can't be told adequately how supremely, amazingly awesome it is as well. So I think that's the tricky thing about people telling you, oh, you're never going to sleep again, or oh, this is, you know, you actually also can't be, the flip side of that can't be described adequately either. It's not like having a cat, however much you adore your cat, it's very different having a baby. So, you know, or don't, I think that's the thing as well, we cling to, or we're told, you know, because people do in a helpful, trying to be helpful way, go, oh, get the sleep you can now because you're never going to sleep again. But at the same time, it's not like someone is just for no reason stopping you sleeping. It's your baby who you are looking after and feeding. And it's a very, you know, it's a sort of, it's a double symbiotic relationship you're having with your baby. Yes, they're taking your sleep, but also helpfully they are hugely enlarging, is that even a word, in growing your heart and your mind and your spirit. So it's not just black and white, kind of, it's tough on the other end. It's just this kind of crazy, as you say, roller coaster with a blindfold.
Oh, I can't wait. My cat has definitely got me in practice because he comes in the middle of the night screaming. I adore him. I don't know what he's going to do when this little baby bobcat turns up. He is not going to be.
Struggling a little bit, I imagine.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, sometimes cats are like, you know, they're like, oh, it's a new baby, that's fine. And they're fine. Other times they get a bit annoyed being.
Yes. He, I don't know what he's going to do. He's neurotic at the best of times, so we'll see. So something else that I really want to talk to you about, and sometimes it's around the terminology, and well, in this instance, I'm going to ask you about the terminology, and kind of it's a more, what's the word I'm looking for, condensed, I suppose, period of time. So we've got prenatal, so that's when we're pregnant. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm just questioning myself there. But yes, we've got that. We've got postnatal, which is after we've had the baby. But there's this other period, isn't there, called perinatal. So can you talk to us about that? Because if that comes up, it can be frightening to kind of ask what that is. So let tell us. Yes.
And it's also only, it's a term that has only really been sort of bandied around for the last few years as well. So, I mean, clinically or medically, perinatal is the period between around week 28 of pregnancy to around week 4 or 5 in the postnatal period. So it's quite a kind of structured timeline in terms of, you know, the medical side of things. But I think it's generally received in the, you know, certainly in the space that I occupy in the kind of pre and postnatal wellness and physical and mental health, I would always view the perinatal period as the entire pregnancy and at least the first year of motherhood, because there's so much hormonal fluctuation and physical change and, you know, that your cycle recalibrating after you've had your baby, that I think to limit it to the first 4 weeks or 5 weeks postnatally is sort of, you know, not that useful. So I think when you talk, particularly on kind of a space like Instagram, for example, when you hear the word, or when people use the word perinatal, they're usually referring to around, or basically 9 months in, 9 months out. So that kind of, you know, that first year of motherhood beyond your entire pregnancy time. So I would view if someone came to me, you know, and they had a 5-month-old baby, I would still view that as being within the perinatal framework. So yeah, that's helpful as a perinatal.
Kind of.
If you think in that kind of nine months in, nine months out type time.
Yes.
But it's really tricky. You know, technically postnatal, if you went to a GP, you're only really categorized as postnatal for 6 weeks, and that's completely useless and bonkers anyway, because that's an arbitrary timeline that was kind of set up around about the Second World War. So it's not, I don't often think that these labels are to be taken as an absolute, you know, concrete label forever. I think perinatal for me is that first year, 9 months to a year after you've had your baby. Postnatal is forever. You are, once you've ever had a baby, you are postnatal.
So that also almost surprised me more that you say that that's only a 6 week period, because I think of postnatal as literally, like you say, pretty much forever. Yeah, that's really interesting. And so within the kind of traditional version of perinatal, we have the birth and we have what they, I don't know who they are, call the baby blues.
Yeah.
So this is somewhat separate in my understanding. So you tell me, good, bad or ugly, to everything that we've talked about up to this point. For me, the baby blues, from what I've heard, from what I've read, is like a period of, like, not specific, but like a couple of days, quite early on, 3 to 4 days after birth, that you really can experience that low. Tell me if that's a load of rubbish or if that's...
It's not a load of rubbish. It's not, absolutely not a load of rubbish. The physiology of it is that in creating our baby within our body, we have also conjured up an entirely new organ, the placenta. Now, no man ever could ever create for himself a new organ within his body. So we are pretty amazing magicians, and we don't get the credit that we deserve. Women,
I'll take that. Yeah. I think we're all pretty amazing.
So this placenta that we've created is your kind of basically your hormone magic wizard within your body, which creates your levels of hormones needed to sustain your pregnancy and also to sort of keep you going as well. It's like your turbo booster. And when you have your baby, you also birth your placenta. So that amazing magic turbo boosting hormone charge leaves your body. The first few days of your baby's life, the first sort of 2 days, certainly, the baby sleeps quite a lot. I mean, not in a kind of overnight type way, but your baby will spend, and this didn't happen to me first time around, actually. My birth, I slept hardly at all in the first couple of days. But most normal inverted commas newborns sleep a lot. So the first 2 days, you're on kind of a, hopefully you're feeling like a birthing goddess, however your baby has come out, and you've got that kind of euphoria and adrenaline that's going on because of that birthing experience. After around day three, day four, a few things happen. It's this hormonal sort of watershed. Suddenly you're without all of those hormones and your body has suddenly come to a stage where it's like, oh my holy hell, what do I do with this lack of, you know, progesterone supercharge and all of these things that have been sustaining your levels of, well, just your optimal levels of functioning, you haven't got anymore, and you need to start getting back into track. And your body kind of hits a wall of just not being able to function in that day-to-day way that it has been before. Combined with that, after 3 days, that's probably when your milk is coming in fully, even if you're not breastfeeding, that still will happen. So even if you choose then to just allow that milk to go away and not be fed to your baby, you will be producing that milk, and your boobs are like watermelons strapped to your chest suddenly, like these huge rock hard, however small your boobs were before, they become these kind of slightly terrifying kind of Barbie boobs. And that is physically really a huge event. It's incredibly painful, not the word, but it's more like, it's a big physical challenge that you just can't prepare yourself to for, is having these incredibly tender rock hard milk vessels suddenly strapped to your chest. Trying to get your baby to also then drink from said milk vessels is another challenge. And then 3 days in, 4 days in, you've probably literally not really had much sleep, so your baby will be sleeping in sleep cycles throughout the day, but be waking up at least every 2 to 3 hours throughout the day. So they don't have any sense of, you know, daytime and nighttime. So you are operating on a 24-hour system suddenly. You're experiencing every hour of the 24-hour with all these physical, hormonal, you know, mental health issues going on. So it's kind of no wonder that after 3 or 4 days, particularly when, you know, as I say, the sort of euphoria or that sense of adrenaline, whatever birth experience, hopefully you've had a positive one in that stage, but if not, it's even more kind of depletion of the adrenaline. you'll suddenly after 3 or 4 days be like, oh, I'd actually quite like a long sleep now, or, you know, and you hit that physical kind of wall. And so it's sort of no wonder that you get a bit tearful and exhausted. And that's when you just start feeling like it's all a bit much. So it's completely normal and to be expected that a few days in, you just get a bit like, oh, I need a bit of help, or you cry a lot more, and it's totally, totally normal. What happened, and it doesn't, might not happen for everyone. You know, it certainly did for me first time round, but then again, first time round, my little one, for various reasons, he was very tiny when he was born, overdue, but obviously issues with my placenta. And so he cried all the time, like a colicky 6-week-old when he was 1-2 days old. So he didn't have any of that kind of sleepy newborn stage. When they're about day four is when they start being less sleepy all the time and slightly more demanding of feeding and that kind of thing. So again, all of these aspects suddenly mean that day four things start kicking off in a way that they didn't really before. But second time round for me, I didn't have baby blues at all. So I think that's the really important thing to say as well, that if you're expecting it and it doesn't happen, then you start questioning, you know, because I remember my midwife or my health visitor coming around day five, and she's like, so how, you know, has been crying, you know, and I was like, I really haven't. And for me, I was almost like, when is it going to hit? Because I haven't been crying. Partly for me, I think it was because my second experience was so much more positive than my first. And I was much more, had many more tools at my disposal. I kind of knew how to look after myself better. I ring fenced my visitor time in a much more healthy way, that kind of thing. But also partly because it just didn't happen. You know, I think so. It's one of those things, it's so individual. That's physiologically and hormonally and sleep deprivationally why it happens after 3 or 4 days. You might find it happens for you, or, you know, you generally, people listening, after a week, maybe 2 weeks. The key is to see that. If it continues then beyond that point, so if you feel, so for me, first time round, after 6 weeks, for various reasons, breastfeeding being the main one, I was still sobbing every day, quite a lot. So I spent a lot of my time in tears. And that's not, that's when it becomes something to kind of check yourself and think, actually, this isn't normal, in inverted commas. This is something that requires a little bit more of a support system in place. When it goes beyond the baby blues and into kind of being something that is a regular part of your day, when you can't remember a day that you haven't been crying, that's when it's actually like, okay, maybe I need to kind of seek support from this. This is no longer simply hormonal. It's probably a lot to do with sleep deprivation, mm-hmm. But it's not just simply hormonal. I think also it's really important to say lack of sleep is a real kicker when it comes to your mental health. So it's really normal to feel tearful and rageful. So for example, if your husband or partner, you know, is having a bit more sleep than you and is snoring, for example, that can really trigger feelings of rage towards your partner. And it's A, important to know that that's very normal, but B, really important to keep the communication lines open. So tell your partner, tell them before you have your baby. So it's really important for them to know as well that lack of sleep, hormone fluctuation, the physical discomfort of the postnatal period. So whether that's breastfeeding pain or milk coming in, whether that's pain from your birth experience, pain from your uterus contracting postnatally, which first time round doesn't tend to be that painful, but certainly second or third experience, it can be almost like sort of pre-labour pains or early labour. All of these things your partner isn't experiencing on a physical level. So the person who hasn't had the baby doesn't have that side of it either. So it's really important before you have your baby for you there to be some understanding that your partner needs to kind of, yes, they need to look after their personal mental health and their physical space and their sleep, but they also really need to step up for you and know how much you're physically going through and really be on hand to just nurture that. And if that means that they need to, if you've made a choice that you're going to do all the night feeds, maybe your partner needs to sleep on the sofa so that they don't irritate you with their snoring, you know, that kind of thing. It's really small things which become quite massively big things when you're in the thick of that baby blues first 6 weeks kind of period. It's a very intensely challenging time for everyone, intensely wonderful and magical in immense ways as well. But it's really important to know that, you know, just becoming lack of awareness of your patterns when you start sniping at your partner or start kind of feeling rageful but without acknowledging it. These are the things that if we don't notice them, we carry them on. You know, we kind of start to build up resentments or you know, feelings of anxiety, anger, all of these things. Very, very normal reactions and responses. But unless you're noticing that you're having them, that's where the issue, you know, may lead itself to become a greater thing as it goes forward.
It's like the main kind of thing that I'm hearing with all of this, and again, there's a couple of things I want to kind of pull out from what you've just said. It is that self-awareness, isn't it? It really is. And it's just being as conscious as we can be, and we don't know how conscious we will be able to be, but about how we're feeling and like you say, kind of how prolonged some of those feelings are and the impact it's having on our life. Like that feels like the main kind of lesson or piece of advice that I'm certainly taking from this. It's, you know, it's none of these things are definitely going to happen. None of these things are definitely going to happen in a way that someone might tell you they have, or that you read about it, or when that people say it's going to happen. But it's just being, I think, aware of all the things that might happen and then being aware of ourselves within that situation. And then
without fear, without kind of waiting for something to happen to you, instead notice what is happening to you. I mean, I would also sort of suggest, I know that smartphones are amazing, and I don't know how mums managed without them 20 years ago when they had new, you know, 40 years ago, how everyone sort of got by sometimes, because they are such a lifeline. But I would also say that there is that sort of lure of the scrolling when you're, especially if you're feeding in the middle of the night, etc. And what I would say is, even just swapping one scrolling session for just journaling or jotting down one or two words for how you're feeling that day can be really amazing and powerful way of just keeping track, because when we're on our phones, we're distracting ourselves from how we're feeling. And often when you are feeling a bit low and you're on Instagram or something, you end up in that comparison trap of going, I'm not as good as that person, or judging someone else and then judging yourself, and it ends up being a sort of slightly mixed blessing for your mental health. So even if you can just swap one of those sessions, those scrolling sessions, for having a little notepad and just jotting down things that you remember about the day, even like, you know, how tiny your baby's toes are, or, you know, little zooming in things that you really, you know, you lose otherwise. Smartphones are brilliant, but they have numbed our experience quite a lot, especially our early motherhood experience, because you spend so much time simply kind of the early newborn stage can be quite boring if you're comparing it to your regular life where you get stuff done. And we're already in a society, in a world where we like to numb ourselves with endless box sets and endless scrolling. So when you're sitting on the sofa with your newborn feeding for hours on end, because babies feed a lot, and I think, again, that's even if you're bottle feeding, you know, they need to feed pretty much constantly for the first 6 weeks of their lives, and then some, you know. And so we do spend a lot of time, in inverted commas, doing nothing. But actually, you're doing everything. You're sitting bonding with your baby, you're giving them nourishment. But I think because we have this, I'm going to get bored, I need to do something, we'd always spend that time on our phones, which is great. And I, you know, again, I absolutely did it myself. But it's being able to also offer yourself the ability to use that downtime to kind of just explore. This sounds really, really worthy, but explore yourself within a little bit. So maybe just deep breaths, just journaling a couple of words, how you're feeling. And then as well, when you've got them written down in a little journal or a book, little notepad, you can kind of track them a bit more, because then you can flick back over the last couple of weeks and think, actually, yeah, I've been feeling really low for 2 weeks now. Maybe I need to do something about it. As opposed to, I think we can allow time to go past with just not really catching it, not really noticing it, you know. And I think it's a really important skill, or just a habit to develop, just having a little notepad nearby. And every time you're feeding, or every time there's some trigger for, instead that you would scroll on your phone, just jot down a few words of like, how am I today? What am I doing today? How brilliant am I today? So I think, again, we don't really appreciate how amazing it is to sit feeding your baby we just think, oh, I'm not doing the washing, or I'm not tidying up, or I'm not, we put all these shoulds in that experience. And actually your baby is small for such a small period of time. It feels like forever when you're in it, but it won't feel like forever when you're out of it. It will feel like it went in the blink of an eye. So being able just to sort of fix that experience a little bit more mindfully is just so powerful.
Perfect. And I am not a journaler necessarily, but because of the cacophony of everything that's going on around, that totally feels like the right time, like you say, even just for a couple of words, just so you can actually look back clearly and see how you were feeling during that time. I am going to have to wrap it up here. I'm just going to finish with one thing, and that is, get your partners to listen to this. Get them to listen to this. I am also working on an episode, whether it will be this series or next series, from the partner's point of view as well, because they have got this whole life change thing that they're going through in a similar but different way to us, ourselves, if we're the ones having the actual baby. So
they need the support and the understanding, and you know, the we do need to notice what dads and what partners are going through. There just needs to be generally much more awareness of everyone's experience in a nurturing way, I think.
Exactly. But for the meantime, if you have one, get your other half to listen to this, so they've at least got an understanding of what you're going through now and will be once baby arrives. And Anya, there was so much information there. I could listen to you talk, no word of a lie, for like an hour more. I really could. So thank you so much for sharing with us. I really, really appreciate it. And
thanks for having me.
Oh, no, you're so welcome. And I'll put all the links to your website and everything in the show notes. And yeah, just thank you so much.